This is literally my third attempt at recording this. But hello. We're back with part two into this deep dive. And there's so much left to touch on. Last week I gave you guys the base facts of the Ramseys and who they were as people, as a family and whatnot, and I set up the scene of the crime. Like every crime that I dive into, I just want to encourage all of you to do some research on your own as well, because I'm not perfect. I will never be perfect. I will never report anything perfectly, especially on older crimes like this, because all of the information has been so muddled through time, and trying to piece together as clear of a scene as possible from multiple sources from different years and even different decades, it's a lot. So, you know, the things I get wrong, you're not going to know unless you do the research also. If you even care to know, I mean, not everybody who listens to this is going to sit down and try to piece together everything and try to solve this. But just if you want a better picture. But welcome back. And if you're here for the first time, welcome to Crime in Theory, a podcast dedicated to everything outside the parameters of normal. I am your host, Ashley. Now, if this is your first episode, please just hit pause. I will be here waiting for you with bated breath, I promise. But please go back to last week's episode, because there's a lot of information there that will make this episode make a lot more sense. Unless you just live for the chaos. I mean, if you want to listen to this episode and try to fill in the blanks with your own mind, you know what? No judgment. No judgment from me. I don't care what you do with your life, as long as you're safe, okay? But without further delay, let's get into part two of the murder of JonBenet Ramsey. Sources are still going to be listed if they are directly quoted. Otherwise, my sources are just the first 15 pages of Google. I've been to so many websites, it's painful. There's no coming back from this. None. But a quick recap for those of you who decide to live for the chaos. JonBenet Ramsey was a 6-year-old beauty pageant queen who was found dead in the cellar of her own home in Boulder, Colorado. She had a head wound and had been strangled with a garrote. Is it garrote or garrote? Garrote's a name, so garrote. Okay. Now, this was after Patsy had found a ransom note on the stairs early the morning of December 26, 1996. All of this happened within the confine of one day. She and her husband, John, JonBenet's father, had called the police, even though the ransom note said, "Do not call the police," and there was no sign of their daughter anywhere in the house. There was no sign of an intruder as far as they could tell, nothing. The ransom note was worded very strangely, and the amount that the ransom note demanded was a total of $118,000, which is also very bizarre. I mean, most ransom notes would say things such as, if you want your loved one to live, give us $50,000 by the end of the day or else, or $100,000, or $1 million, whatever. And so much in this case was handled so poorly. From the handling of the scene, to how police approached the case, the suspects, all of that. Can't fully blame them because they weren't equipped to handle a homicide. Or really even a kidnapping, because apparently, I wasn't there, I don't know for a fact, but apparently Boulder was a very safe place to live. Now nowhere is safe. Welcome to 2022. But the police zeroed in on Ramseys as suspects, as did the media. It was a lot for them to deal with. I mean, it does seem fair that they were considered as suspects because their daughter was found dead in their own home. There are other suspects that did not receive the same amount of energy. Please make it make sense. Investigate everyone thoroughly, not just half-butt, okay? And JonBenet's murder has never been solved. This December, in the year 2022, will be 26 years. On August 6th of this year, she would have been 32 years old. One thing that I didn't address in the last episode was the total amount. I just mentioned it. It was $118,000. If the ransom note wasn't worded strangely enough, the amount demanded, of course, was really weird. Like, I already said that. Here's the kicker. I'm not sure if it was the previous year, as in 95, or that year, as in 96, but John Ramsey's bonus check for that year was for that amount almost exactly. It was $118,000 plus a couple hundred more. So did the ransom note writer think that rounding down to $118,000 would be less suspicious? Who knows? But either way, there is no way that that amount was included coincidentally, which means that whoever wrote that note knew exactly how much that check had been worth. Now, this clue alone should narrow down the list of suspects significantly, but that means that the Ramseys still were not eliminated because obviously they knew how much John made. But that also includes those close to the family, friends, other family members, people that John worked with, etc. So at least we now know that the entire city of Boulder, Colorado was not on the suspect list. And now we're all caught up from last week's episode. Now, the Ramseys did not help their cause any when they supposedly refused to work with the police in the investigation. But let's look at it from a different lens or a different angle for a minute, okay? John came out saying that he had no problem working with the authorities. I mean, if he's innocent, why would he have a problem working with the authorities? It doesn't make sense. The issue itself was that when police wanted them to come in for official interviews, John explained to them that Patsy had fallen into a horrible depression, deep grief, however you want to consider it, and she literally physically could not get out of bed. He asked them, "Is there any way that you can come to my house to conduct these interviews because my wife cannot get up?" Of course, they were like, "No." I do understand that when they were initially interviewed, Patsy and John were not separated. And that's kind of a big no-no because it's easier to corroborate each other's stories that way if anyone's lying. So police wanted to keep them apart for interviews, obviously, because it's a lot easier to catch a slip-up that way. But as a person and not a cop, I do understand that depression can get so bad that you cannot get out of bed, and a little empathy from the police department would have gone a very long way. And I do understand that police need to interview on their turf, and making a special exception for one person means that you would have to make that exception for everyone. It was just a very messy situation where neither of them were really in the wrong on this, though. But police saw this unwillingness, if you will, to meet on their turf as being fishy and guarded. And I just don't know that that was the case. Also, I mentioned the autopsy last week, and I gave a rundown of what the coroner found. One thing that I failed to mention was that the coroner found food in Jeanmonet's stomach that resembled pineapple. And that, in and of itself, doesn't really seem like a clue. Kids eat, you're gonna find something in their stomach, right? But police found a bowl of pineapple left on the table with a spoon in it in the kitchen. Patsy and John both denied giving her any pineapple the night before. So how did the pineapple wind up in her stomach? It's kind of unclear. Now, Burke's fingerprints and Patsy's were both found on this bowl of pineapple. I don't know if Patsy admitted to giving Burke any the night before, but there is a theory floating around because of this one bowl of pineapple. There's a lot of holes in this theory, a lot of questions that need to be answered for this theory to make sense. But it does make sense to a degree, I guess. Now, if you're familiar with this case, and who isn't, then you'll already know that this bowl of pineapple is why people think 9-year-old Burke murdered his sister. The theory goes that Jeanmonet had taken some of this pineapple, which was supposed to be for Burke. She wasn't supposed to have any because sharing apparently is not caring for a child. And Burke picked up a flashlight from somewhere. I don't know if it was in the kitchen or what. He hit his sister in the head with it and killed her. And then John and Patsy found out what he did, stepped in, covered it up to protect their son. But here's the thing. The blow to the head did not outright kill her. A simple check for a pulse would have been enough. They could have called an ambulance and quite possibly saved their child's life. So why strangle her after? I mean, yeah, that would have proven that Burke had some behavioral issues and... But that doesn't mean he was without empathy. You know what I mean? I don't know. Also, the blood in the underwear doesn't make sense with this theory. It just doesn't. Why would they go out of their way, fashion a garrote, and literally strangle their own child to finish the job that Burke could not? It makes no sense to me. And there are people who literally have latched onto the word pineapple and they think, well, Burke did it. Burke did it because there was pineapple in her stomach. Also, even if she did sneak down for a bite of pineapple, so what? I mean, as a theory here, just a theory, what if she wet the bed, got her mom up, her mom got aggravated, cleaned her up, whatever, which could explain the agitation in the vaginal region. She was already awake. Burke was eating his pineapple because Burke went to bed later than JonBenet. She took some pineapple, ate it, went back to bed, and then the crime occurred. But nobody wants my theories. I'm sorry. I'm not sorry. This is my show. I can theorize. It's called Crime in Theory, not Crime and Ashley Sits Here and Shuts Up. But I'll go more into this detail about the theory when we get to the suspects episode, and I will discuss them as suspects. But that's the basis of the theory. But John and Patsy wound up sticking by their story that Burke had actually been asleep in his room all night, so the pineapple remains a mystery. And since we're on the topic of possible clues, police found something interesting in the cellar. They wound up finding a boot print near JonBenet's body, or where her body had been found, not near her body, because John had moved her. And supposedly, this boot didn't belong to anyone in the home. Supposedly. It was actually difficult to determine even the size of this boot, so my assumption is that it was a partial print. But apparently the tread was there enough to determine what brand, and they narrowed it down to being probably a high-tech brand boot. So, I mean, that's a start. And if there was an intruder, police believed that the best point of entry would have been that broken window. Now, there was a spider web on this window, and many people believe that the web would have been disturbed or even completely destroyed had an intruder entered this way. But the thing about spiders is that they tend to repair their webs if they're messed up. And it takes usually between about 30 minutes to an hour at most to spin a fresh web. I mean, I got this information from a very quick Google search. It was the first information I had, and it was for a basic household spider, but easily, a spider could have very well repaired their own web or even spun a fresh one between JonBenet being left in the cellar and her body being found by John around 1 p.m. I mean, 30 minutes to an hour was all it would have taken. And last week, I believe I did say that the window had been broken prior to the murder. John said that he had broken it when he had locked himself out of the house one time. It happens. And an intruder could have possibly entered this way because of that. Not to mention they had threaded some cables through the window when they were setting up Christmas lights. I mean, there are some things saying that an intruder couldn't have entered that way, like the fact that nothing was really disturbed outside. And if someone did come in that way, there was bound to be something disturbed, right? But there was an unlocked door as well. So there was another way in for someone to enter the home undetected. And for anyone out there asking, well, if anyone did break in, how did nobody hear them? According to one report, the house was heavily carpeted, so sound absorption. And as to why JonBenet didn't cry out or make any noise herself, two theories off the top of my head could be that the intruder could have been someone she knew and or trusted, or the intruder could have applied the duct tape while she was asleep, just very quickly. Done. You know? And the blood found in JonBenet's underwear that I briefly mentioned was blood belonging to a male. Therefore, definitely not her own. And not her mother's either. The garrote that had been used on JonBenet, as I said last week, was made from a paintbrush handle. Part of this brush's bristle was found in Patsy's art supplies. And the cord used as the other part was made from nylon. Just in case anybody was wondering more details about all of that. I don't know if the nylon cord was also from the Ramsey home or not. Only 2 days after JonBenet had been found murdered, the Ramsey family made their way to the police station to answer questions and give samples for forensic testing. Patsy, of course, was still in her grief and wasn't able to make it. And John had lawyered up already, and the lawyer made it very clear to the cops that they were done with the Ramseys. Like, curtains, you're done, unless the Ramseys had legal representation with them. It might be a little odd that they had a lawyer only 2 days after the crime. I mean, sure, one would think that they would want to do anything that it took to clear their names in hopes that the cops would move on to the real culprit, right? Well, I'm gonna play devil's advocate again, it's what I'm good at. John was a wealthy businessman. He probably had a lawyer waiting in the wings at all times anyway. And the case was already being televised all across the nation, and common sense would tell you that this meant the cops were also under constant scrutiny by the Boulder population and their higher-ups. So they probably wanted to wrap this case up ASAP. The Ramseys were already suspects in the cops' eyes. It's pretty obvious. So it wasn't likely that they even wanted to look elsewhere. Again, just me playing devil's advocate and using many years of true crime docs and podcasts to draw conclusions. I am in no way an expert. John could have very well wanted this case solved, but he wasn't naive. He didn't get where he was by being stupid, by any means. And he still had the rest of his family to protect. Even if it did make them seem more suspicious, legal protection was more important than public opinion. And 5 days after the discovery of JonBenet Ramsey, on New Year's Eve of 1996, JonBenet was buried wearing a pageant gown and a tiara in Georgia. Life was already messy enough for everyone involved, but it was about to get messier. It always does, right? Remember Fleet White? He was a close family friend with whom the Ramseys visited on Christmas Day. Well, he was also there when JonBenet was found, and according to the article on Medium.com called Unsolved Mysteries, Who Killed JonBenet Ramsey, written by Michael East, Fleet did not offer any comfort to John upon the discovery of his daughter, which is kind of strange. If your best buddy found out some devastating news, would you not comfort them? But remember that John had removed the black duct tape from his daughter's mouth. Fleet had picked it up, thinking that he recognized it. See, he and John had taken multiple sailing trips together, and John kept white sailing tape. The black duct tape reminded Fleet of the sailing tape, so the wheels in Fleet's mind were probably turning at this point. Supposedly, Fleet tried to convince John to cooperate with authorities, but John wasn't having it. At least that's according to the Whites. The Ramseys, however, said that Fleet began acting quote-unquote erratically. How erratically, I don't know. But needless to say, the friendship between the two families was done. And things were never the same. In trying to figure out what happened to their daughter since BPD really dropped that ball, the Ramseys made a website, or they probably hired someone to make the website. They also hired a handwriting expert, or multiple rather, and even a former FBI profiler. The handwriting expert makes sense. Now keep in mind, they had the money to do all of this. They even hired 3 PIs, 8 lawyers, and 4 publicists. Now my question is, if this family were guilty, why would they go out of their way to hire all of these people? Why would they make a website dedicated to finding who killed their daughter? Could it be a ruse? Could it be trying to make themselves look innocent in the public eye? I mean, yeah, I guess. But I'm sure there's a much more affordable way to do that. And like I said, the handwriting experts did make sense. The one the police used said that it looked like Patsy's handwriting, the note. Then there were others saying, well, it's similar, but it couldn't be officially determined. Listen, this whole part was a wild ride, okay? A report from 97, June to be specific, mentions that John was officially ruled out as the writer for the ransom note. But, like I said, Patsy couldn't officially be ruled out. And the very next month, Seraph Security Consulting and Training Company gave a report that it was a quote-unquote close match for Patsy's writing. But further down the timeline of this chaos, a federal court ruled it very unlikely to be Patsy's writing. Like I said, a wild ride. But before this handwriting mess, back in April, the Ramseys were named as official suspects. I mean, the public already thought of them as such, and the police did too, but now it was officially spoken out into the world. There was no taking it back. They were brought in for interviews / interrogation on April 30th. John was questioned for about 2 hours. And Patsy? They put this woman through the ringer for 6.5. I'm only speculating, but it seems like they really thought Patsy was the killer here. So Patsy, who had female DNA, somehow left male DNA in her daughter's underwear. Okay. This whole train of thought from the police force seemed to have derailed before it actually left the station, but all right. And with a lack of hard evidence that someone else had broken into the home, the chance of someone already in the home committing the crime increased in the eyes of the Boulder PD. I mean, the garrote used was fashioned using a paintbrush from Patsy's paint supplies. We already talked about how her fingerprints were on the bowl on the table. And John found her... Nope. And police supposedly found her palm print on the door leading to the cellar. They found fibers from Patsy's jacket on the blanket that covered JonBenet's body, on the tape that covered her mouth, and in the ligature part of the garrote, I believe. In JonBenet's underwear, they found fibers from a black wool shirt belonging to John. Touching on one thing real quick, I'm going to admit that covering a body with something like a blanket can be considered an act of care for the victim or even a sign of remorse. So, I mean, yeah, it does look like someone that knew her did this. And it's really puzzling, but I'm going to just leave that there. And I'm no lawyer, of course, but I'm pretty sure any lawyer worth their weight in salt would... Is that the right phrase? Anyway, I'm pretty sure any lawyer would view all of this as circumstantial evidence. I mean, Patsy's prints were found on an item from Patsy's own home? Whoa. Crazy. Never would have considered that. You're saying fibers from a shirt in the home were found in the underwear that had also been in the home even prior to JonBenet wearing them? Do you know some people just toss clothes into the wash and then just dry them all together and they don't separate them? Also, what about the theory that JonBenet wet the bed? Was John wearing that shirt that night? What if he went to the clean clothes, grabbed a pair of underwear out, could have transferred them? I'm just saying, there's so much to this case going on here. And the fibers on Patsy's jacket. I mean, washing a jacket and blanket doesn't seem as likely because it would tear the blanket up, whatever. But, I mean, I guess it's possible. But who's to say that Patsy didn't wear that jacket and have the blanket and carry it somewhere? Any of this is possible, is all I'm trying to say. And as for the fibers being found on the tape, well, John removed that tape from JonBenet's mouth, and then the tape was on the floor, and then it was picked up by Fleet. Tons of stuff could have been transferred to that thing. But the fibers were also found in the ligature used to kill JonBenet. Now that one isn't so easy to explain away, but that doesn't mean that there isn't an explanation. And the palm print might not even be Patsy's. This is kind of confusing. I mean, either it's Patsy's or it's not Patsy's, or there were multiple palm prints. I'm genuinely not sure because this part was very convoluted. But according to extras.denverpost.com, nobody's palm print taken from the Ramseys and their friends matched the one left on the cellar door. Police actually did one thing right, I guess, which is they got warrants. They got the warrants for the computers in the home, CDs, CD-ROMs, floppy disks, Gen Z, just ask your parents. All kinds of things that
are pretty tech related, videotapes, all of that. Anything that could have had a recording on them of some sort. They were searching for either child and or adult pornography. But do you know what they found? Nothing. They found nothing on every single piece of evidence. There is no way that the Ramseys would have had time to wipe everything. And I promise it's not that I'm trying to straight up defend the Ramseys here, but everyone has focused on them for so long that I'm just trying to look at it from a different angle, because looking at it from the Ramseys did it angle has gotten us nowhere for 26 years. So stop yelling at me. It's not nice and we're all allowed to have our opinions. Thank you. I mean, this case really has so many people divided, but stop yelling at me. You have your opinion. I'm not yelling at you for having yours. Okay, thank you. And remember last week when I read off the 911 call? Here's the interesting part about that call. Steve Thomas, who is a resigned detective from BPD, who actually worked on the case, wrote in his book JonBenet Inside the Ramsey Murder Investigation that there were three voices detected on that call, excluding the 911 dispatcher. An enhanced version of the audio picks up John's, Patsy's, and Burke's voices, allegedly. All of this is alleged for legal purposes. I am not saying anything is set in stone and nobody's accused of anything, okay? Not for me. And so what if all three were detected on the phone call, right? I mean, that was their family that was missing. You know, it wouldn't be a big deal if it wasn't reported that Burke had been in bed the entire time. And I don't know if all of this is true. I don't know if that third voice is Burke's. I'm going to assume it is because he was 9. It's pretty easy to detect a child's voice. But it's never a good thing to lie to the police. Even if they thought it was a small lie, just to protect Burke, it's a bigger deal than you think it is. Now, in the TV special, The Case of JonBenet Ramsey, they allege that Patsy had said the words, "What did you do and help me, Jesus?" Allegedly. John can also be heard saying something along the lines of, "We're not speaking to you," while it sounds like Burke asked the question, "What did you find?" Also, according to the dispatcher that spoke with Patsy, she got a hinky feeling about the call. She said it seemed, quote unquote, rehearsed. And I would take what she says with a grain of salt, but when you're doing this on the daily for so long, you do know the intonations of people's voices. And you can tell if it's genuine. I'm not saying she's an expert, and I'm not saying that she couldn't have made a mistake. I'm just saying. And let's get into that ransom note for a minute. Armchair detectives on the JonBenet subreddit have pointed out specific lines of this note. So, it's theorized that whoever wrote this note had to be big into movies. The length of the note alone feels very movie scripty. I mean, it was 2.5 pages. And because, like I said last week, that real ransom notes are usually short, sweet, and to the point. Well, minus the sweet part. But on top of this, the writer quoted multiple movies throughout this thing. One line throughout the entire thing, maybe accidentally quoting a movie, I could get past, but it's a lot. And the ransom note writer clearly had not one shred of originality in their body. So you tell me if these lines sound familiar. Now listen to me carefully. Listen very carefully. And then there's, "If you talk to anyone, I don't care if it's a Pekingese against a lamppost, the girl dies." Or how about, "It sounds like you had a good rest. You'll need it." These are all lines from the movie Dirty Harry. Don't think he's a cinephile yet, or whoever wrote the note? Well, how about this? "Do not attempt to grow a brain." That's from the movie Speed. And how about the movie Ransom, which was still in movie theaters at the time of the murder? In this movie, the kid is bound in a similar way to JonBenet with his hands above his head, and the child was also duct taped. Oh, and who is this kid? None other than the child of a wealthy businessman. Other parallels to this movie include the specified denomination of bills. and the kind of container to be used for delivering the ransom money. And remember in the note how the quote-unquote kidnapper mentioned using counter-surveillance? That's in Ransom 2. And let's talk about the movie Nick of Time. This movie was on TV at 7:30 p.m. on Christmas Day night. Fleet and Priscilla White had this friend. His name was Bill Cox, and he was staying with them at the time of the kidnapping slash murder. Of course, because of that, he was interviewed, and he told police that he watched the movie that night. This movie is about a quote-unquote political faction who kidnaps someone. Any guesses as to who they kidnap? A 6-year-old girl. There's also similar quotes to the note. Like, you talk to a cop, you even look at a cop too long, and your daughter's dead. I'll kill her myself. Cut the head right off in front of you. While it's not a direct quote, the ransom letter writer threatened to behead their daughter. And how about, quote, you need to listen to me carefully. 3 lives depend on it. Very carefully, end quote. Now, we don't have to agree on this, but I think it's pretty clear that the writer took their life as a cinephile pretty seriously. So much so that it translated into their apparent life of crime. And I'm going to end it here for this week. But don't worry, there's still a lot to dive into. Don't stress. But stay safe this week. Don't forget to look at the clues from every angle. And as always, don't get haunted. I'll see you next week.